All righty. Welcome to the Horse Geeks podcast, where we talk about or look at riders from the inside out. I am Kirsten Nelson, professional horse trainer for Wexford Training and developer of the program Training for Optimal Balance. With me again is the lovely Deborah Merrow, who is a professional, I have to make sure I get this right, orthopedic massage therapist, also a certified Alexander Technique instructor, and founder of Optimal Posture. So today's topic is a little bit of a carry-on, and excuse me for looking at my notes, but I just make a few notes and I do have to refer to them. But how words translate into actions is what we're going to talk about today. And before we get started, I just want to quick say that the Horse Geeks podcast is hosted on my YouTube channel. If you want to follow it, you can hit the subscribe button. Also, if you're into the whole Horse Geeks thing, I also have a playlist for Horse Geeks lessons where some of my students will actually give me permission to share their actual Zoom lesson, which Deb does. Deb's lessons are on there. So if you want to audit some actual Zoom lessons, those are on the same channel. And I've been putting up Horse Geeks hacks, how to do simple things around the barn or different big concepts for training or riding. So there's another playlist for that too. So if you guys are interested, you can hit subscribe. You can see all the playlists on the channel and have at it. It's all fun information.
Fun.
Okay, with that out of the way, how words translate into actions. And I made several notes. I'm not exactly sure where to start other than words translating into actions is, to me, how we receive information, like as a student in a lesson, listening to an instructor, or even in like a yoga class or a dance class or something you're doing physically, we hear the words, but every single individual can interpret those words differently based on past experiences and understandings, based on how they might imagine what that's supposed to feel like, or how we perceive the world through our five senses gives us a unique experience. It's unlike, we all have the five senses, but how we receive information through those five senses and interpret it in our brain is truly unique to each individual. And so trying to muddle our way through as students, especially learning to ride horses, we hear, oh my God, the ubiquitous instruction, heels down, right? Heels down. But if you sort of go, well, what does that mean? What do I mean, put my heels down? Okay, that's kind of a body part in a direction. But if you think of the articulation of all the leg joints, people's flexibility, what stirrups they're in, how long the stirrups are, how much experience they have, I go, there's like an infinite potential of how somebody could actually in detail interpret that simple instruction, heels down.
Yeah, and I even look at it as questioning, why are we giving that cue? What are we seeing as an instructor that we want changed?
I think on heels down as a particular instruction, the reason it is heard across the country in every riding arena is because as humans, our instinct when we crawl on the back of a horse and we feel all that force of motion and we get unstable is we go to the fetal position. Mm-hmm. So as natural predators, we go fetal and we grip inward. And so what that translates to with our feet in the stirrups is toes down, because if we grip inward with the legs, we tend to point the toes down and the heels up when we're just gripping with our legs trying to hang on. So it's a great instruction for a totally novice rider, because most novice riders are struggling with finding their balance straddling a horse without sort of pulling inward with the arms and legs. So the heels down is very useful for a human, maybe the first, I don't know, if you're doing a weekly lesson, say, then maybe the first 6 months of riding, maybe a year if you're not taking a weekly lesson, but more is not better. It's really, I think, originally an instruction to get us out of the fetal gripping position on the back of a horse. That to me is the only place it's useful.
Right. And I read an article, it's on the alexandertechniquescience.com. It's a study summary called Lighten Up, Trying Hard to Stand Up Straight. So all of those words that we use as instructors, what the article addresses is they took a group using stand up straight efforting, another group where they said relax, another group where they said lighten up. And there were huge differences in ability to balance.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So could we, so as an Alexander teacher, I'm looking at a rider, student, doesn't matter what they're doing. Can they do that activity without shortening around the activity or getting shorter or using a lot of effort? How do we help the rider, person, horse, for that matter, be stable, but not, like you said, gripping, locking down, those kind of things? So I get the heels down at the beginning because that rider doesn't have any past history.
Right. There's no point of reference, and our instinct
right. Is
heels up, legs in. So the original heels down as an instruction is really just to help the rider overcome the human instinct. But what ends up happening is the vocabulary, like you said, the vocabulary doesn't change. And so when the rider is reminded heels down, we also do a very human thing when we think more equals better.
The effortful, that it has to be a lot of effort. It has to be hard. Right. I have to work harder.
Yeah. And sometimes it can feel like a lot of effort when you're first learning something, but as you habituate a new skill of movement, it doesn't feel as hard, just like learning to ride a bike feels terribly difficult until you get the balance and the coordination. And then it's never that difficult again. And that's kind of like riding. So people who are still struggling to put the heels down, over time, that searching for it to be difficult and full of effort and still hearing the same instruction leads to excessive flexion through the ankle joint for the human, which then stresses the knee joint. It opens the knee joint too much and you'll get knee pain. And then it also locks the hip joint up in the seat. So excessive heels down actually destabilizes the rider's seat because it takes all the mobility out of the hip joint, and it can create ankle pain, knee pain, foot pain.
And I like the points you went over that are critical is balance and coordination. And when we start to, in this same study, when they found that when, instead of focusing on that heels down, that specific body part, but refocusing on the head, neck, back, and torso, that balance and coordination, then they found everything else fell into place.
Yes. And yeah, when we're riding, our legs are not our stabilizing units like they are when we're walking or moving off a horse. When you're riding, your legs become shock absorbers.
Ooh, so I like that.
Having availability, that sort of equal degree of flexion and extension through the hip joint, the knee joint, and the ankle joint. So if you're riding with really short stirrups, like jumping, you're going to have an acute angle between the torso and the thigh, which is your hip joint, between the upper leg bone and lower leg bone, which is your knee joint. And then your heels are going to look down because between your lower leg and your foot in the ankle joint, you're going to have the same degree of bend. And so if you have the same degree of bend through the hip, the knee, and the ankle, your legs act like shock absorbers. That's what
I like, that shock absorbers. And to me, a shock absorber, like you said, that availability. So when I'm riding, especially, we've talked about this before, but there's something about when you put your feet in the stirrups that you tend to brace, that can become something you brace against. And once you start that, it goes all the way up. So I'm always asking myself, are my knees available? Are my hips available? My hip joints, not my pelvis, but my hip joints. And what about ankles? And just asking myself, am I locking that? Is it available if I had to absorb something?
Exactly. And as riders, again, our instinct when we're off the, well, our habitual use when we're off the horse is to get a sense of balance through the weight in our feet. And when you put your feet in the stirrups, it sort of triggers that human instinct to look for your balance through your feet. And you have to learn how to translate that sense of equalness or levelness on your feet all the way up to the bottom of your pelvis, to your seat bones. That's our feet in the saddle, is really the seat bones. And so all of that, just talking about a simple directive, heels down, I go, it's not wrong. Mm-mm. But things that are too simplistic can get interpreted a gazillion different ways. And at some point, it goes from being useful to hindering us and actually making us unstable. So it's not wrong instruction, but we have to go further. And I actually wrote this down because as a student, we hear a lot of the same phrases, like a lot of the phrases in a riding lesson haven't changed since I was a teenager taking lessons.
They haven't in 50 years.
Yeah, the words haven't changed.
At least 50 years. That's what I did my thesis on. Yeah.
And what I learned to do as a student, and I'll come back around to this, but especially having instruction, having you work on me and different Alexander Technique instructors work on me, it opened my mind to go, what you're saying to me in a riding lesson, I know has a very clear meaning to you as the instructor in your head, but I'm not sure I'm clear. Could you show me what that feels like? Or could you further describe what you're asking me to do? How would you do it in your body? Like kind of as a student, not just sort of taking the information and feeling stupid if you don't get it, but to learn to ask questions, to go, okay, what is it I'm not understanding? Because I'm getting the same words over and over, which means I'm not producing the result that the instructor is looking for. So as a student, learning to ask questions and break it down so that it has meaning to my experience. Is I always have the right to do that as a student.
And I wonder if, you know, and that brings up a whole nother level of communication between teachers. We started pretty much our whole podcast about students and teachers and students.
Yes.
What is the relationship between the student and the teacher? Does the student feel safe and able to ask those questions?
Yes, sometimes the teacher has to make room for that and has to kind of give people permission, because the perception, and I've seen this a lot, that it takes a long time to learn about horses, and people who get good with horses can have a tendency to think people who are not good with horses or aren't translating the words they're using appropriately, it's easy to look down on the student. and think, oh, they're just not getting it. They're not trying hard enough. They're not listening. They're not that smart. But I go, I really believe if you're able to own a horse, you're smart enough to be successful in life. So you start with the premise that just because somebody doesn't know what they're there to take a lesson on, whether I'm the student or the teacher, I go, not knowing doesn't mean I'm stupid. I'm perfectly capable of learning. And I apply this when I hire, you know, business advisors, tech support, work with different banks or CPAs or lawyers. I go, look, just because I don't understand it doesn't mean I'm not capable of learning it. I'm not a stupid person. So don't treat me like a stupid person or I'll go somewhere else. So that's what I see is a lot of students in the horse world. These are smart, intelligent, successful people who own horses. I go, it's, you can't be broke and own a horse. Like, it's way too much of a life. It takes over your life to own horses. So these are people who are dedicated, who have the money to own horses, which means they're smart and successful in the rest of their lives.
And they're seeking help. If they're looking for a teacher, I feel it's my responsibility as a teacher to help that student understand what I'm trying to tell them. Maybe I need to change the way I'm looking at it, the way I'm phrasing it. Maybe as an Alexander teacher putting hands on, I may see a problem in a specific area, but that doesn't mean that's where I need to go.
Right.
Yeah. So
the dialogue is the learning.
Yes.
The dialogue between the student and the teacher is where the learning occurs. And as a teacher, if I see somebody's not understanding or able to integrate what I'm trying to get them to understand, I change my words.
Right.
And it's a little bit like throwing spaghetti against the wall. You got to stick. You know, it's, you don't always know how people are interpreting the words you're using. So as a teacher, I try to find analogies or different words, or what I really learned through being an Alexander Technique student was what I also learned with horses is the nonverbal communication is like a massive download of specific information all at once. I go, nonverbal communication through our sense of touch transmits more detailed, specific information than words do. Words are sort of the representative of the experience, but I go, when you ride a horse, you're not speaking to them in concepts and words. It's a feel, just like if you're dancing with a partner or when an AT instructor puts hands on me, I'm getting new information through their hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've also, I experienced, and with horses, and I imagine with people too, it sometimes it's just, it could be the way you walk into a room. You know, I was working with someone on the lunge line, and it's so interesting when you have somebody else lunge or work with your horses, you know, that you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And she was naming a certain problem she was having with her horse. And I said, okay, well, let's come over and we'll see what happens. And the same thing happened. It never happens with me and my horse. But as soon as she got on the end of that line, the same thing happened. So there's something,
yes,
that person is bringing to the equation that is allowing those things to occur. So, well, I was out riding and I wondered what some people bring to the table. This, what does the student bring that we're not even aware of?
But the horses are aware of.
And the horses are.
Right. And that's where the mythology of the horse whisperer comes from, is because It's through the sense of touch. And if you expand the sense of touch outside of your body, what we would call personal space or energy, it's still the sense of touch. You're communicating. Horses are highly perceptive as prey animals to that nonverbal communication. In a language, it would be your tone of voice, your rhythm of speech, your kind of your volume. Like, there's lots of ways to describe it if we're talking about public speaking, where you communicate energetically with words. They're not separate.
Oh, I like that.
Right? So I can take a simple phrase like, sit still. Mm-hmm. Right? So sit still, it's a directive, but I can change the energy behind the word. I can change the rhythm, the tone, the frequency, all of that can change. So sit still, the way I said it, sounds kind of neutral, right? But if I go, sit still, right? What am I trying to convey? I'm trying to bring someone down a little bit. That was just the tone and the rhythm. Or I could say, sit still,
right? Most of us have heard.
Right? So if I say sit still to somebody who's already kind of jacked up, that doesn't help.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it does. It's very situational. You know, I can take the same phrase and change the tone behind it and the frequency, and it has different meanings, even though I haven't changed the words. And so what you're talking about, where this woman comes and lunges your horse, who's never done it before, suddenly reacts like her horse that she's having the problem with. And I go, that's how specific the language really is.
Yes. That
half the time, we don't know what we're saying to the horse, but we are definitely saying something, whether we're aware of it or not.
I think that's a great point. I'm wondering if we are ever neutral. You know, I wonder if we are always saying something, whether we think we are or not.
Absolutely. From the moment I go out with a halter or even have the intention to go get a horse, that conversation starts as soon as they notice me. Maybe they notice me before I even notice they notice me.
Exactly.
I mean, their level of sensitivity is off the charts compared to humans. It's like how we move, what we're thinking and how we're feeling is going to color our body language. Just like a tone of voice puts a different meaning on the same words, like sit still, right? So if I'm going sit still, sit still, sit still, that's sort of a way different directive than sit still.
Or sit up straight. I mean, how many times have we, what's that?
Right.
Yeah. So if we have to, as teachers, have what I call different tools in our tool belt for different students. And being that, you know, I worked in classrooms and taught everybody. And that's another thing I like to ask people, and a lot of them don't even know, How's the best way do you learn?
Right.
Are you a visual learner? Are you, I'm a kinesthetic learner. I want the hands-on, I need to feel it. Do you need it written down? You know, and a lot of people don't even know that about themselves.
Right, although people who love to ride almost always do, we have probably like kinesthetic learners are the smallest part of the population. Like I think auditory is first, visual is second, and kinesthetic is sort of the third most common way people learn easiest, but it's the highest percentage of riders. And probably I would think dancers too, or people who do something physical, that they're naturally kinesthetic learners. So we have a very high percentage of kinesthetic learners in the horse world. And that just makes sense to me, of course, because we all want to ride. We don't even know why we want to ride, but it feels good. So that language And it's just like somebody who's a really strong visual learner might gravitate to photography or art, where they like using that particular sense. We all have the sense of sight, but to be a really good artist, photographer, videographer, something with the visual arts, you refine that natural sense. You develop your eye, right? For artwork or in photography, they say you develop your eye because there's certain rules of framing, but you're really cultivating your sense of sight. And people who maybe learn auditorily gravitate towards music, right? So to develop your voice or play instruments, you're refining your sense of hearing. So to speak with horses in this nonverbal communication, we refine our kinesthetic sense, our sense of touch. We pay more attention to how we feel and what we think, because that's part of the, it's a big part of the nonverbal communication. You can't lie to a horse. It's like, they just know. Even if you're lying to yourself, your horse knows. Because it's oozing out of our body, whether we have to learn to control, have self-control over what we're thinking, how we're feeling, and how we're using our body in very specific ways to speak the language the horse best understands. But I go, just like a chef or an artist or a musician, we can cultivate our sense of feel and we can become better and more sensitive. And that's what riding is really about. And I think too, that's what your 3 years of work, studying the Alexander technique is, work on yourself and develop that sensitivity to the touch before you go out and share it with other people.
Yeah, and that's the hardest thing is, it's one thing to work on yourself, but it's another thing to work with the horse. But when you combine working it with me, either riding or putting hands on people as an Alexander teacher, how am I using myself when I have another subject there?
Yes.
That I'm dealing with. And maybe that's kind of like what we're talking about here. It's like, it's one thing on the ground and then the horse is by itself. And energetically, once you match those two up, what's the energy that's going on between the two?
Right. And that's where I consider myself more of a translator than I do an instructor.
I like that.
Yeah. The capacity of people to use their sense of touch and sensitivity to energy, it's in there. We're born with it. It's one of our five senses. It's not something you learn to do. You don't have to learn how to smell. You just smell, right? And I mean, receive smell. I don't mean smell that. That too. We don't have to try to do that either.
We're horse people. We're good at that.
But it's like our sense of touch, we're born with it. And people go, oh, I don't have any feel, blah, blah, blah. I go, if you know if your shower is too hot or too cold, you have feel. If you know you just touched a hot stove, you have feel. Of course you have feel, you're born with it. But learning to control it, to have self-control over how you use your body and how you manage your mental and emotional state, I go, that's a learned skill. It's a refinement of the sense we're born with. And that is ultimately the form of communication with the horse. So like, I find it hilarious that, people are very big on teaching a horse verbal commands. And I go, okay, we're supposed to be the higher intelligence. Can we actually learn to speak their language rather than teaching them to speak our language?
That's interesting you brought that up, because I've always been taught, squeeze a horse to go, pull a horse to stop. Just that basic rule. So, Callie, my big mare, I was riding her today and I gave her a leg aid to go forward, and her response, and I kept my leg on because she wasn't responding the way I wanted. Mm-hmm. So then she kind of pushed back away from me, and I went, isn't that interesting? So then that gets my wheels turning, and I'm like, well, how do I communicate to her what I'm asking? So I did just this very, very less than touch. And she goes, oh, okay, now I hear you. Yes.
Yeah. No, which is another thing that cracks.
Being silly human.
Yeah. I go, the horse's language is physical touch and the energy related to physical touch. That is their language. I go, that's what we have to learn how to speak. And humans are capable of that. But what cracks me up is not only the verbal commands, but if the horse responds, like in your mind, you gave your leg aid, which to her felt like a vice grip, right?
And she's like, went, right?
Like, what the hell? And so you changed what you were saying, and then she understood. But a lot of times, people will go, then they'll back it up with the whip, or they'll get harder or firmer because the horse didn't have the response they expected. And I go, horses are always communicating with us, whether we like it or not. Most of the time we call that communication bad behavior, but it's really just them telling us they're confused, they don't like it, they don't understand, you're not stable. They're telling us a million different things. But what cracks me up is a person getting harder, where instead of what you did, which was try a different leg aid, it's still a leg aid, but you tried a different tone. You tried a different communication. But when people just get harder and harder, it's like the equivalent of how human instinct, if we don't speak the language or we meet somebody who isn't good at speaking English, right? Americans tend to talk louder like it's gonna help them understand, right? It's like, no, it's a different language. Talking louder or slower is not really gonna help if you're speaking two different languages. So getting harder and harder on a horse that has bad behavior is just screaming at them in English and they speak Chinese. It's like, no. It louder is not going to make it any easier for the understanding or the actual communication to be conveyed. But yeah, that is all part of translating words into action, increasing sort of the energy of our muscle, or going to aids, or even going to spurs or harsher bits, or all these other leverage devices we have with horses to get them under control, is like basically hog tying them or putting tape over their mouth or like telling them to shut up and don't talk to us. We're just, you know, you just need to do what I say. And I go, that's where horses shut down, or the horses with a stronger sense of self-preservation fight back. And that's the realm of horses that get labeled as difficult, mm-hmm. right? And so getting louder, which when we're talking about nonverbal communication, that is jacking up your energy level or having a stronger, firmer physical touch, which could also be more leverage, would be a way to have a much stronger physical touch than you're physically capable of. And all of that doesn't clarify what you want from the horse. It doesn't actually communicate the action that you want the horse to do.
I think I like those words you use, communicate, and you said you were a translator. You feel like you're more of, so I'm wondering, you know, I think, you know, way back when I used to be one of those riders who kept pushing and it usually always backfired on me. So as I age, I have more information now, you know, I've really educated myself, and I think changing the way we think we communicate with the horse might be helpful too. Be a better listener, maybe. Be a translator instead of a controller.
Absolutely, because if things are going south and the horse is, like, when they get confused, that's sort of the first layer of defensiveness. It's not an unsafe layer of defensiveness, but if they're confused, they're confused and they start to get protective through fight or flight behavior. And if we escalate that, then it goes from confusion to fear. Now the horse really feels unsafe, which means we're unsafe. And a great example of this is I have a horse in training right now who's just being started under saddle. He's a young guy. And the first day I was working on, because with a green horse, you teach them that the leg means forward. That's not a gift. You teach them that, right? And you teach them that two reins with a little bit of pressure on the nose or the mouth means stop your feet, and your leg aid means start your feet. So there's two different ways to kind of teach a young horse the leg aid. You apply the leg lightly but clearly. And then you can take the reins. If you're in a snaffle bit or if you're riding in a halter, you can tie the lead rope around into a set of reins. And some horses understand the leg aid by giving the leg first and then sort of rocking the front end, sort of pulling on the right rein till they step or shift their weight, then the left rein till they step or shift their weight. And you kind of go back and forth and it unbalances them a little bit. And so they end up taking a step forward. Well, I did that on day one with this young horse and it was terrible. He just started pulling on the reins. It was a big hot mess. Eventually he kind of understood. He took a few steps forward and sideways and I quit there. But it was not pretty. It wasn't dangerous, but it was just, he put up a lot of fuss and was pretty defensive. So the next day I changed my strategy, because the other strategy that this horse might understand better is apply the leg lightly and then tap behind the leg very lightly with the whip. And if you've been doing your groundwork, they understand the whip means forward, right? So that worked like a charm. He got it in 5 minutes. What was a bunch of chaos the day before. But if we're not willing to change our strategy, I mean, we're supposed to be the higher intelligence. We should have multiple strategies and to get across what we're trying to teach our horse, right? And when we ride, we're supposed to be the teacher, which means just like I am working with a horse and rider together, if one or both are not understanding what I'm trying to convey, I have to explore my words, my metaphors. I have to try maybe something more than auditory, maybe show them something visual. Or a lot of times go and say, look, your leg could be this light instead of having to be this hard, and show them physically what a light leg gait means on their own leg or on their calf. So that's what I mean that the touch is very clear communication, and to the horse as well. So how we change our touch or how we balance our bodies changes the conversation dramatically.
Yeah.
But we have to think, if the horse is struggling, even if it's not unsafe, if they're struggling, they're showing us they don't quite get it, they don't understand, or they don't like it being explained in the way you chose to explain it.
That's a good one.
And that was this green horse. The first day I thought, well, a lot of horses like this sort of rocking with the reins. He was having none of it. He was like, up here, this sucks. Don't want to do it. I'm going to fight you, right? So the next day I changed my strategy, different horse.
And you know what, that I think is the key in any type of student-teacher relationship. Is being that adaptable to figure out, even with people, like, how do I get this message across?
Absolutely.
And it's not maybe what I did yesterday with the same person, with the same horse.
Right.
It may have worked yesterday and it may have worked for 70% of the horses in the past. but not today, not this horse.
Right. No, and translating words into the action, which is what we're trying to learn, it's like we have to think in terms of, I have my words, which are representation, but I also have, like, I'll use music sometimes, which is an auditory form of learning, to teach people sort of that rhythm within a speed, say a trot speed, that there's various stride lengths, tempos, and miles per hour that make up the rhythm of the trot. So music, an auditory tool, can really facilitate that as an experience, right? Or sometimes as a teacher, and I think The Inner Game of Tennis was a really good book. And one of the things about a book, if you're gonna teach, and one of the things he talked about in The Inner Game of Tennis, I can't remember the author, was show people to the best of your ability, the ideal, right? So like a tennis swing, say a backhand swing, he would have people watch him several times and then do it.
I think that is one of the key components of my work is, and that's why we spend, you know, the first 2 years working on ourselves, is because our own use, the way we use our own bodies while we're teachers,
right,
is a huge role model influence for our students.
And sometimes it's even sort of subconscious.
Oh, it's, yeah,
something that we just pick up by
completely observing,
like watching the teacher. It's like you'll pick up mannerisms or body use, even though you might not be conscious of picking that up. That's part of the visual learning, right? And then the kinesthetic learning, it is the language of the horse. So a lot of times I will like take reins in my hand and just have a set of reins between me and the rider and say, this is what your horse is feeling from you. Or if you're the horse, you hold the reins, you be the horse, and this is what you're feeling from me as a rider. Which all of a sudden, take a rein contact. It's another one, like heels down. What does it really mean?
Hold the reins, take the reins, things like that. Those words to me are, to me, they're like a loaded gun. You know, right. Holding, controlling, instead of listening, maybe listening with the reins.
Absolutely. Or I always find myself, because it's a big point of confusion in communication between horse and rider, it's often that contacts are confused with aids. So in the horse business, mm-hmm. in riding, we have a seat, a leg, and a rein contact. That's all we all have as riders at the end of the day, no matter the saddle or what other gadgetry you have. We have our seat, our leg, and our reins, which are our arms. And a contact, I have to explain to people, is a touch that receives information.
I like that.
So a contact is where we listen to the horse. It's not an action. An aid, like teaching this green horse, the leg aid, I'm increasing the muscle tone of my legs and giving a light squeeze. And that aid means I'm speaking, I'm giving direction, right? So the aid is where we speak and the contact is where we listen. And a lot of times the aids and the contacts get confused. So if the horse doesn't understand a leg aid, we just keep banging and banging and banging with legs, or go to spurs or drive with the seat. And it's like, well, no, the aid puts in the request and the contact receives information about whether or not the horse understood your request.
And that is so, because when if we're visually looking at somebody, horse, rider, doesn't matter. And we're having a conversation and we're not getting the message across. Sometimes just putting hands on, you go, Oh, now I get it. Now I get what's going on. If you're that receiving of information kinesthetically is what we do a lot as Alexander teachers, because we may see something, but maybe the information we're giving isn't the right information to make the changes needed. So having that contact to receive information, helps me tremendously to teach.
Absolutely. And that's how we communicate with the horse. So if our legs or seat or reins, and rein contact is tricky, but the reins are transmitters that help us feel the front end of the horse, because our arms are not that long. We can't reach the mouth, right? But to feel the head, neck, and front leg use, we get a lot of information through the reins if it's a contact where we're receiving. But again, that's not sort of fully explained. So people just, we hear the words, take a rein contact. But that could involve 10 pounds of pressure, 2 pounds of pressure, 1 pound of pressure, 10 ounces of pressure. And the same with the leg aid, like you were describing. You gave your horse a leg aid, and in your mind, were perfectly clear and reasonable. And she went, up yours, I'm going backwards, I'm pushing back. I didn't like that. That was rude.
Rude, how rude.
and it, that's women, right? It's like, I'm not yelling, right? Yes, you're yelling. Men are like, I'm not yelling. And women are like, they're screaming at me. And the mares are the same way. So what you thought was reasonable communication with the best of intention.
The best of intention.
It doesn't mean you were wrong, and it doesn't mean she was wrong. But communication is a two-way street, right? So you altered the pounds per square inch of your legs or the muscle tone and energy. And she went, now I can hear you. Speak softly to me, please. Right? Quit yelling. La, 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 la.
That's 1,300 pounds of, I better figure out how to do it nicely.
Yes. There is sort of that large 1,000-pound powerful weight factor and safety issue that gets you motivated.
Thinking I can make that 1,300-pound thing do what I want it to do?
No, you can't make them do it, but they will cooperate if there's something in it for them. I think they enjoy the conversation.
I think they do too. If it's an intelligent level of communication, I think my horses most of the time are eager to go out and work. They like it.
Yeah. And if they don't like it, they let us know that too. And it's not personal, but it can be a little ego bruising when they tell us they don't like it. But we have to think of it as a back and forth communication. And just like as a student, when I take on a mentor, I might look stupid and I might feel stupid as I'm going through the learning curve, but I know I'm not stupid. I go, eventually I'm going to figure this out, right? So I look at a student that I'm working with as a teacher the same way. I go, they're not stupid. Even if they look stupid right now, they're going to get through it. They're going to learn. And the same with the horse. When I'm helping a horse learn something, I go, they can do stupid stuff, but that doesn't mean they're stupid. You ultimately have to really believe, and most horse owners know, you don't have to believe, that horses are very intelligent creatures. They can think, they can consciously and cognitively learn. Otherwise, we couldn't ride or drive them.
No, we'd all be dead. Yeah, we'd all be dead. I would have been dead a long time ago.
And you learn, especially, I don't care how big and strong you are as a person, I go, a 250-pound, 6-foot guy who's riddled with muscles is still outmatched pound for pound with a 500-pound mini. You know what I mean? I go, that's still a lot of weight with 4 feet on the ground. They'll take you out at the knees.
Right? Or a donkey. Right.
And even, I mean, you think, for us to think that we can really leverage, and it is possible, we can create enough pain that the horse will subside because they're prey animals. But really, to think about leveraging around 1,000 pounds, 1,500 pounds, 2,000 pounds, at some point, even a big, strong guy will find a horse that he can't muscle around. Some horses really learn how strong they are and what badasses they can be. Mm-hmm. And they become very dangerous horses because they've had enough. They haven't been treated fairly. And so they resort to that eventually. They're natural flight creatures, but they will resort to aggression when that's their best option.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I think as women, like I used to try to keep up with the cowboys, and I finally had to find my own way. And that's what I saw with really masterful horse people, was horsemen and women. They were usually older, 60s, 70s and above. And by that time, the men had sort of like calmed down enough that they weren't so using brute force, but they were better with horses not using brute force. And I learned early on, if I'm going to deal with a difficult horse, they're going to eat my lunch if I try to like muscle them around. I go, I just don't have it. I'm not physically capable of what a 6 foot, 250 pound man is capable of. I got to find a different way. And what I found was I could be persistent and patient and communicate clearly. And then I not only kept myself safe, but some of these difficult horses really turned around with less bucking, rearing, bolting, drama, safety issues, all of that. That started to dissipate. And I went, huh.
Isn't that interesting?
They will communicate with you. So the last point I wanted to talk about was like what I learned with, because there's a lot of people will ask me a lot, what are some things I can do to kind of learn better body skills and control to become a better rider when I'm not actually riding? You know, and mostly they'll ask me like, you know, Pilates or yoga, or I work out at the gym, I need to build more muscle to have a rein contact, that kind of thing. And really, what I loved about the Alexander technique work was before I experienced that, I used to say, well, dancing with a partner is probably the closest you can come to riding. And you can actually talk to your human dance partner, which isn't always pretty either, but that's kind of the closest to this nonverbal communication is dancing with a partner, like ballroom dancing. And I learned quite a bit about body control through Tai Chi. So those used to be the two things I would recommend. And even though Tai Chi is slow, it's with a lot of awareness and it's balancing your weight while you're moving, right? And becoming aware of energy. But then when I did the Alexander technique work, I went, oh my God, that's exactly like what I experience when I ride. And all the other endeavors, like I, you know, yoga, Pilates, all the other standard stuff. And even there's a similar work called Feldenkrais, which I used to confuse with Alexander technique. So I did some lessons there, but it's more like they talk you through exploring your own body. It's more verbal and you physically do your own exploration of how to use your body, which there's huge value to. I'm not discounting that at all. But as soon as I worked with an Alexander technique instructor and I got hands put on me as a transmission of information, I went, oh, I never would have figured this out ever.
That's a good way to put it.
My own personal reality or experience of movement, what I got through the Alexander technique person putting hands on me, the instructor putting hands on me, was new information. I mean, the blueprint's in there for better movement in the construction of the body, but kind of you don't get an owner's manual. So we all have to learn how to use our bodies better. And I found, maybe as a kinesthetic learner, again, that hands-on was so clear. And it was new information to my nervous system. I could have been talked through that for years and never discovered what I discovered from an AT instructor putting hands on me. I go, that to me was what made me really gravitate towards the Alexander technique work, was I went, that's like riding. When I'm helping a horse balance, they're getting new information in their nervous system. There's no way to verbally do that with a horse, number one, but through riding, through the contacts, the aids, the balance, your understanding, you help a horse discover how to better use their body. That's what balance is. And it can only be communicated through touch and feel.
Yeah, I really like that. Helping them or people discover what is in there. What's available, what you can tap into that you didn't know you had.
Absolutely.
And you didn't know it was there. And I always say, you've always got to have a teacher.
Yeah. We all need help.
We all need help. We're even Alexander teachers, you know.
Absolutely.
We need that information.
Yeah. Because we have the construction and we have the blueprint of how to most optimally, like you have optimal posture, I use optimal balance. That blueprint for optimal use of the structure is in there somewhere. But sometimes we need outside information. And I find when it comes to the body experience, at some point, it's got to be a kinesthetic communication. It's got to be through touch that we gain an awareness or an understanding that we was never in our experience prior to that moment. Like I found that mind blowing. I go, there were things I discovered about how I was using my leg muscles or my back or my head and neck balance that you could have talked to me for a million years, but it was an overwhelming download of information in a 1 hour session.
Yeah, and the thing I like about it is it's unraveling. You know, it like you said, you found out one thing, and then you're questioning, what am I doing with my legs? And
right,
you know, it just keeps unraveling. It's an internal conversation.
And that's what riding a horse for balance, to develop the movement of the horse, is that same ongoing conversation.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
And so if we as riders don't become fluent in the horse's language, we're really held back in how far we can take that conversation. Mm. You know, we can live in the land of baby talk, which is heels down, give leg, take a rein contact. I go, that's just baby talk to a horse, right? And horses will get bored with that because they're intelligent creatures. I think they really like that more intimate communication non-verbally of you listen, you guide a little, you listen some more, you guide a little. And sometimes, a lot of times I'll ride and just sort of relinquish control when it's safe to the horse. Like I won't steer or I won't play with the speed. And sometimes I'll just ride around and listen. What is the horse choosing? And more times, not, I don't want to say more times than not, but maybe 50% of the time, the horse shows me something that was a better idea than what I had in mind to show the horse. And I go, that it humbles you the more you learn, and then you listen and you go, ooh, this horse does not want to follow the theory book. This horse kind of figured it out in its own way, going a different direction than I had planned. Either slower than I thought was good, or faster than I thought was good, or lighter or heavier or something that I didn't expect.
I just got a thought in my head. What makes us think we have all the answers?
It's hubris, absolutely. Hubris. And
how much ego is playing on that card?
Yeah.
But you know, and we don't do, I mean, I'm always asked, I do that a lot. I've sent you videos of, I don't know why my horse chose to go up and down these hills, but that's what we're doing today.
Yes. Yes. Letting the horse have some choice is part of receiving the communication.
I like that. Yeah.
We can start to go, well, why are they making these choices? Or why are they having this kind of response? Do I need to change my communication? Do I need to help them more? Do I need to help them less?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I just need to shut my mouth.
Shut up.
Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Right? I'm sure my mare said, I know my mare said that to me many times. Shut up.
Oh God, I wish you'd learned how to ride.
No, and my little Arabian mare is one of the smartest horses. And oh my God, she just made fun of me ride after ride after ride. She's like, you'll figure it out, dear, but you don't have it today.
I like that. I think that's a good point to really look at. You know, the horses are pretty intelligent. They may know the answer, and we just need to get out of their way sometimes.
Yes. And just because they don't speak verbally doesn't mean they don't communicate all the time. And that is the language we have to learn. And it's like, just because somebody's from a different country, well, if you're French, you know you're more intelligent than anybody, especially if somebody else speaks English, right? So, but it's just a different language. It doesn't mean there's a lack of intelligence. And Mother Nature's intelligence, it doesn't always make sense to the human, but we can't look at the horse as inferior. We have to look at them as different.
I like that.
They have a different kind of intelligence to bring to the table. And we have a different intelligence, but we and the horses are both part of nature. Nature is not separate from the human being. We're part of it. And so we can learn to kind of speak that language. And horses are great at teaching us that because they're kind of like teenagers. I mean, they're highly opinionated. They're going to just tell you exactly what they think. And if we can receive that as information rather than labeling it as disobedience, bad behavior, some kind of character assassination like lazy or stupid or crazy or ADD, if we just take it as communication, we can begin to develop that relationship and learn to speak their language.
Good point.
Yeah. So anything else you wanted to add?
Nope, I think that's it.
I have the token cat. So how words translating into action, and I guess what we're talking about with nonverbal is how actions become words.
To them, yeah.
That is a two-way street. Actions are words, and words translating into actions. In communication, we don't always get that right off the bat.
I think sometimes we are not great receivers of information.
As writers.
Yes. As writers.
Right. And so, and also as teacher to student, having the confidence that we are intelligent, even if we don't know what we're there to have a lesson on yet, and the teacher trusting the same, that the student has an intelligence, even if they're not yet competent in what you're wanting to share with them. So looking at kinesthetic, nonverbal communication, but also auditory and visual communication. How people receive information is also how they learn. And everybody's different.
Yes.
So I think, I don't need to recap anything else.
I think that we're good.
I think we're good. All right. So thank you guys for joining us for today's podcast. Hit subscribe if you want to follow them regularly. And we'll be back
Be kind, everybody.
All right. Yes. Be kind and see you later, horse geeks.